Thank you, my Lord, for the invitation to speak here this evening. Sorry, slides skipping ahead. Here we are. That's brilliant. Thank you. So it's a little overwhelming to be here among a number of very eminent speakers and individuals who I suspect know rather more about the subject than I do, but hopefully I will present a slightly different view and something of interest for you all. So Patrick summarised many of the core issues, so I won't dwell on them. Other than to say, you know, we know that business are the main funders and performers of R&D in the UK, and we know that in every economy which has achieved the scale of increase in R&D that we are aiming for, that it has been primarily business that has driven that. We also know that business expenditure on R&D in the UK is below where we think it should be. One thing Patrick didn't say is if we adjust this for certain aspects of our economy, it looks a little bit better, but it's still below OECD levels. So really, we need to focus on business expenditure on R&D and work out what we can do to increase that. So I'm going to really try and focus a bit on some aspects of business expenditure on R&D, BERD. I also want to pick up a few of Chi's points about short-termism and link them to a few questions of executive incentives, and then maybe finish off with a few observations from my previous role, which would mirror, I think, some of Patrick's remarks earlier. However, before I get into all of this, I'd like to start with a few words about R&D in connection with business innovation more generally. So I'm from Nesta. Nesta is the UK's innovation foundation, and I'm pretty much contractually obliged whenever I speak to remind everyone that innovation is much more than R&D. It encompasses all the means by which ideas create value, including design-based products, business model innovations like those of Uber and Airbnb, service innovations like those of Revolut and Crowdcube, as well as improved internal processes. We know that innovation is key to sustained corporate success, that innovative firms outperform non-innovators, growing roughly twice as fast in terms of both staff and turnover. It is crucial in growing productivity, which in turn is really the only way to improve wages and standards of living. Now, according to Nesta's Innovation Index, R&D represents, sorry, it's probably rather too small for you to see at the back, but R&D represents only around 14% of firms' investment in intangible assets and new knowledge production. That's roughly equivalent to the amount that they spend on design, but significantly less than they spend on workforce training, organisational change, and new software. It's worth examining, therefore, how the UK compares with other countries on this broader measure, and asking whether this substitutes to an extent for firms' R&D spend. In other words, is it the case that British firms are underinvesting in R&D because they are investing instead in other innovative activities such as design and business model transformation, which do not show up in R&D statistics but might nevertheless produce productivity gains? If that is the case, then perhaps we shouldn't worry about the R&D gap. Now, it's been 11 years since Nesta published our report, The Innovation Gap, to examine this question. Our conclusion in 2007 was probably not, that notwithstanding the fact that traditional indicators of innovation performance were heavily biased towards investment in scientific and technological invention, and hence did not capture innovation in those sectors that represented the majority of the UK economy, it was still the case that British businesses did not innovate enough, and thus could not be serving as a substitute for R&D. Now, if we fast forward 11 years, the picture has changed somewhat. On overall innovation performance, the UK now ranks significantly above most EU countries, something of which we should be proud. Our wider spend on intangible assets is also now pretty high by international standards. And our measurable non-R&D innovation activity, such as design, has increased substantially over the past decade or so. However, despite that, I'm afraid that there is still not compelling evidence that UK firms are investing in wider innovation activities as a substitute for R&D. Now, part of the issue may be that we still lack the tools to evaluate comprehensively this wider innovation activity, and that's something that Nesta we're trying to address. But for the time being, at least, I think we cannot let ourselves off the hook this easily. We need more innovation, and we need more R&D. Now, that said, there is an argument for changing the definition of R&D somewhat to include some of these other innovation-related activities that currently do not qualify. So we at Nesta, we've frequently argued that the creative sectors, for example, are undertaking a lot of activity, particularly in areas such as computer gaming, virtual reality, and augmented reality, which do not meet the current definition of R&D, but look quite similar in intent, and which would undoubtedly benefit from the stimulus afforded by R&D tax credits. Changes in this way could encourage more innovation investment in several areas in which the UK excels, although it does risk accusations of moving the goalposts. Focusing back on the core topic, though, it's interesting to note that the long-term average internal rate of return for business R&D has been variously estimated at around 10 to 15%, and actually I think in some studies as high as 30%. So one might therefore expect that enlightened firms and markets in general would encourage more investment in R&D, even if it meant raising funds to do so. So why isn't this happening? Why isn't the market solving this problem for itself? Now, one claim that's frequently made is that equity markets are too short-term in nature. Certainly, much innovation takes many years. The time for new therapeutic drugs, for instance, may be several decades from initial research to market. And by the way, it isn't just a problem with pharma. I mean, I worked for a number of years in commercializing innovations from the physical sciences, and you know, you see this throughout all sectors. But it's claimed that investors are often too impatient to reward firms that invest in this way, and this was the conclusion of the 2012 K review of UK equity markets and long-term decision-making, and it's been echoed by various studies before and since. Why might this be? Well, one possible cause may be the declining percentage of shares in UK companies that are held by individuals, insurance funds and pension funds, which are explicitly dedicated towards long-term growth. Oops, don't know what's happened there. Institutional ownership of companies has been shown to exert not only a positive impact on R&D spend, but perhaps more importantly, has an even larger effect on the productivity of that R&D, at least in terms of things like patent outputs. The theory is that institutional investors are more likely to have a relationship with the executive team of firms and give that team the confidence to take risks and the knowledge that they will not be punished for short-term failures. Now, as this chart shows, over the past two decades, many such institutional investors have been largely replaced by overseas investors. Of course, some of those overseas investors will also care about long-term growth. But as the K review argued, fragmentation of shareholders reduces the incentives for engagement and the level of control enjoyed by each shareholder. Thus, the important point is less about the location of shareholders per se and more about the quality of their interaction with firms. Now, one way in which shareholders exercise control is by influencing remuneration policy and incentives, which is one of the core topics that I would like to discuss. There is a substantial body of academic research demonstrating that individual executive incentives can sometimes run counter to the long-term interests of their firms. For example, one survey from 2005 found that an astonishing 78% of corporate executives would be willing to sacrifice long-term value in order to meet quarterly earnings targets. In a similar vein, there is evidence that CEOs often reduce long-term investment to increase short-term earnings when approaching vesting periods for equity and options. And we do think this is causal. The more equity that CEOs have vesting in a given quarter, the more they tend to cut investment. The converse also seems to be true, that long-term individual incentives have a positive effect on firm innovation. There is evidence, for example, that more long-term incentives, such as restricted stock options, are associated with more heavily cited patents, far more so than short-term incentives. Now, given that much of this academic research has existed for more than a decade, one might expect that both firms and shareholders would be alert to this behaviour. Moreover, given that for most large publicly traded firms, executive incentive packages are now typically many multiples of basic salaries, we might expect that awareness of the risk of perverse incentives would have increased proportionately. Certainly, some companies have moved away from quarterly reporting precisely in order to reduce the short-termist attitudes which those create. But does this mean that the UK's largest companies have adequate individual incentives to innovate? Now, we recently commissioned an analysis of incentive packages across the FTSE 350, and this group is particularly interesting given the relative concentration of Bird in the UK. So our top 15 spenders together account for a full third of all business R&D, and the top 50 firms account for half. By contrast, if you look at independent SMEs, so these are true SMEs that are not owned by larger corporations, they only account for a mere 4% of BIRD. So doubling or even tripling this 4% will frankly have negligible impact on our overall progress towards the 2.4% OECD average. Focusing on the FTSE 350 thus makes sense, since whatever influences these large firms is likely to have significant overall impact. Now, from our work, we found four key points. First, the work reinforced the large number of existing studies in finding that higher R&D activity was correlated with higher net profits. Now, this is not news. After all, this is kind of why we're here this evening, but it's good to confirm that that relationship still holds across the FTSE 350 today. Second, it found that among R&D active firms, the use of innovation-related performance metrics was correlated with higher net profits. Third, it found that across the FTSE 350, there was a clear lack of board-level responsibility for innovation-related functions compared with sustainability or safety, say, where there was very often a clear nominated committee or individual. So, for example, a third of FTSE 350 boards have a committee for risk oversight, a quarter have a committee for sustainability oversight, but less than 3% have a science or technology committee. Fourth, and this is most relevant to what I was saying a minute ago, the work found that only a minority, 37%, of FTSE 350 firms used anything that could be considered as an innovation metric in their annual bonus or short-term incentives, and only a much smaller minority, a mere 5%, used them in long-term incentivization plans. Now, those metrics which could feasibly be considered innovation-related are shown here. Now, the interesting thing is that nearly all, 95% of the metrics that we found were qualitative in nature, which clearly makes it very hard for shareholders to make cross-country comparisons and also work out if they're worthwhile. As you can see, this is much wider than R&D, but explicit targets for R&D spend were found in a mere 2.1% of incentive schemes. Instead, the measures that are typically included in annual bonuses are shown here. Now, looking down this list, and bearing in mind that these are factors in annual bonus schemes, one core question for us is, are these measures more likely to be improved over the course of a year by increasing R&D spend or by cutting it? Now, in all bar a couple of cases, I would argue that these are more easily met by cutting spending, and hence they serve to inhibit innovation. Now, what about long-term incentivization plans, LTIPs? We saw from the previous chart that LTIPs have grown in relative importance over time, which one might welcome. But again, there's almost no direct connection between any of the common metrics we see in LTIPs and R&D activity. Now, it could be argued, and undoubtedly many firms would do so, that measures like total shareholder return that you see in the vast majority of LTIPs incentivize R&D indirectly, and that they would do so if all relevant executives appreciated the link between R&D and productivity or profitability. The problem with that argument, of course, is not only that we might doubt whether executives do indeed appreciate the benefits of R&D, but also that many of these relevant measures can be increased in different ways. So TSR, for instance, can be increased via increasing dividends or by share buybacks. So the link with innovation between these, the link between these and innovation is really quite tenuous indeed. The other factor is that LTIPs are typically only 3 years in length, which is really not long-term by the standards of many R&D projects. The result, in my view, is an incentive structure across the FTSE 350 which does little to persuade firms to invest in R&D. Indeed, given that most measures seem to point in the other direction, I would even go further and say that most incentive schemes, as they currently stand in the FTSE 350, are a barrier to R&D. Now, I'm rapidly using up the 50 minutes I was allocated, but I'd like to actually just mention one other disconnected problem, which I think inhibits R&D in the UK, which is to do with the permeability of the academic industry interface. So we heard from Patrick that access to talent is the number one key requirement for businesses. From my former role as enterprise strategy manager at Imperial, I definitely see that reflecting the conversations that we had with business. Now, the UK has a pretty good concentration of R&D staff. This shows the density, the numbers of researchers and technicians per head of working population. So our researcher density is roughly on a par with Japan and significantly above China over here. However, if one looks at where these where these researchers are located, most are in academia. The percentage of R&D staff located within business is only around 40%, whereas the situation in China is the reverse. You can see around 74% of researchers are in business. We know that much, and quite possibly most knowledge, is tacit. That is to say, it's embodied in scientists, engineers, and technicians, rather than being formally codified or even codifiable. And the best, in my view, and sometimes the only way to transfer that knowledge is by enabling the transfer of people. So if we really want to increase business R&D, I would suggest that we need much greater focus on enabling the movement of academics into industry and, crucially, back again. This last point is important because my first-hand experience over the years is that many academics don't want to move into industry because they fear that it will be a one-way move. In other words, having stepped off the academic track, it will be impossible to resume. There are, I think, many ways to improve this, including clearer guidance for university recruitment panels on how to compare industrial and academic researchers, together with things like more KTPs, more co-location of industrial academic researchers, and linking promotion criteria more clearly with industrial impact and so on. Many of the periodic reviews of university business interaction have discussed mechanisms like these, but none, in my view, have placed sufficient emphasis on tacit knowledge and the actual physical movement of people. There are lots of other things that I'd like to discuss, such as the need for more experimentation in government to build evidence about what works. She mentioned that there hadn't really been a sort of a really coherent rebuttal of the sort of calls to cut R&D. I think, in my view, partly this is because we lack the evidence to really compare the cost effectiveness of different ways of stimulating business and really be able to tailor that to different sizes of business. So we're working with Bayes at the moment to come up with more experiments that we might actually run to build that evidence base. I think also we might, in the conversation afterwards, talk about the importance of open innovation mechanisms such as startup corporate collaboration. Patrick spoke about the attractiveness of small firms to larger firms and the role that they play in bringing businesses into a country. I entirely agree. I think some universities are very explicit about that being their strategy. And we know from our own experience talking to large corporates that the majority of large firms now explicitly have collaboration with startups as part of their innovation strategy. I think also there are good reasons why we shouldn't write off SMEs, despite my appearing to do so earlier. And I also think there's an interesting discussion we could have about the psychological need for some long-term time horizon to fill the role that the millennium once played. But unfortunately, I'm out of time, so I won't delve into those, but I will instead wrap up. I don't think there is any silver bullet for R&D spend. But I do think that a good place to start is by looking at our large firms and considering that investment decisions are ultimately made by individual people, trying to understand whether those people are truly incentivized in the right way. There are positive signs that we are moving in the right direction. The Bayes Select Committee on Corporate Governance called for LTIPs to be phased out and replaced by restricted share plans. And despite the fragmentation of equity markets that I mentioned earlier, there are signs in recent years that shareholders are becoming more vocal about remuneration issues. And for instance, voting at AGMs, which typically is only about two-thirds, three-quarters of people, has been increasing a little bit in recent years. The evidence shows that incorporating innovation incentives in pay does have a positive impact on firm performance. But we need to ensure that shareholders, analysts, investment managers, and companies themselves take this to heart. And hopefully this evening will be a step in that direction. Thank you.